Well, thank you for that fulsome introduction. Thank you all for coming on this glorious spring day when it feels like we should really be drinking beer on the terrace. But later, right, there's still time for that. So my thanks to the House of World Culture, and particularly to the organisers of the Anthropocene series, and to my German publisher, Matthias & Seitz, for making all of this happen. And my apologies for speaking in English, but I'd studied German in high school. You don't want to know how bad it got in the decades since. Who could have guessed when the flood came that it would come in slow motion over 40 decades rather than 40 nights as the polar ice sheets unravel and plunge into the waters? Those who have so mismanaged the fate of all things cling to their private arcs. The animals, one by one, will be saved, if at all, as gene sequences. Welcome to the time of the Anthropocene. But let's not lose ourselves to despair or fatalism. It's true enough that this civilization has ended. We live in the ruins and we know it. This way of life didn't last. But what could be a more exhilarating project than to create a new civilization? Rome wasn't unbuilt in a day. It will take time. History isn't over. It's barely begun. And where are we to find the resources of love, labor, of language to make another world? As Paolo Verno argues, it's a matter of seeing how the past is not just particular pasts, but a past reservoir of potential, a potential for love, of labor, of language in general, from which it might be possible to select different paths. The time for the eloquent exegesis of received ideas is gone. We need other pasts for other futures. There is no crisis of the humanities. There is rather a problem with humanity itself. Our species being is as builder of worlds, but we forgot how to build them, right when we need to build some other ones. Those of us whose labor and love is language, we have a lot to do. We can show how the past harbors unrealized potentials. Sometimes to take three steps forward, one has to take two steps back, back into the archive, that link farm of past potential. We could do with some new stories, new concepts, new affects. The Anthropocene obliges us to rethink both past and future time, and thus also to find the resources in the archive with the potential to interpret these possible temporalities. Such might be a modest contribution to the building of a survivable civilization within the ruins of this one that is passing. This is why, in Molecular Red, I went back to a largely forgotten part of the archive. It's a book that tells two conceptual and literary stories, and one is about the Soviet Union and the second is about the United States. It's a pair of stories about geographically very big formations whose existence in time has been brief. I don't tell the usual Cold War story about them, where one is defeated by the other. Rather, I tell a story about how the decline of one prefigures the other. The Soviet Empire, such as it was, is gone. The American one, the world empire it spawned, is on borrowed time now too. And the problem in both cases is not just the relation of an empire to rival forms of social organization. The problem in both cases is the relation of social organization to the nature on which it depends. If there's a central problem to creating a new civilization, a preliminary way of describing it would be to say it's about the relation between socially organized labor and nature. Now, when I say nature, the term nature has no positive content. Nature here just means that which labor encounters. What anyone imagines nature to be depends on the form of the labor within which they encounter it. Let's try to think nature in this limited and formal way for a bit, to try to sort of bracket off our assumptions about it, assumptions which probably come in any case from past ways in which social labor has encountered it than from emerging ones. So, back into the archive, I went looking In neglected corners of an archive I know passably well, which is a Marxist and post-Marxist one. I was raised on Perry Anderson and Martin Jay and Fred Jamison's construction of a Western Marxism, and then on a series of critiques and dissents and detournements of it by feminist and anti-colonial and post-structuralist thinkers. Those critiques all develop, at least in part, out of a kind of creative use of a Marxist archival past. And there's a lot of exploring of neglected stacks of the library in that. Walter Benjamin, for example, was rescued from semi-oblivion by Hannah Arendt and others. But there's one sort of alternative fork in that archive that, with few rare exceptions, never gets taken. Nobody has that much interest in Alexander Bogdanov. In the first decade of the century, he was probably the most influential Bolshevik, more influential than Lenin. Lenin forced him out of the party, in part by attacking him on philosophical grounds. There's a famous picture of Lenin playing chess with Bogdanov while Maxim Gorky looks on. This is a version of a photo. It's one of those creepy photos where people over time have been erased from the background. Actually, not this photo, the other one you see, take it from the other side. I kind of just figured this out later, but Gorky's son gets erased, for example. Like, the history we're dealing with is a traumatic one. All right, so this is the famous photo. Bogdanov actually won this chess match against Lenin. According to Gorky, Lenin was a bit of a sore loser about it. But then Lenin did manage to sort of checkmate Bogdanov's influence in the Bolshevik faction and have him thrown out. So in the long run, Lenin won and, in a sense, lost everything. Bogdanov would be remembered in the Soviet Union mainly through the attacks on him in Lenin's philosophical book Materialism and Empirical Criticism. Bogdanov's fate was, in some ways, even worse, officially designated as the one who had the wrong philosophy. This was a judgment that the new left actually did not think to overturn, and probably because a lot of them wanted to wrestle the mantle of Lenin from the old left. So the new left is being more Leninist than now, and like didn't sort of question this previous judgment. But this sort of thing always makes me really curious. So who was this Bogdanov? Like, what was his life and work really all about? And like, I don't read Russian, so it was hard for me to find out. Not much is in translation, and still less is in print. It turns out probably more in German than in English. There's a really lovely collection of his materials you can find here at monoscop.org. And a lot of the English language materials that are available there, I take some pride in having like made the PDFs and seen that they got there so that this stuff could then be studied and read and so forth. His magnificent utopian novel, Red Star, is freely available, fortunately. And as I say, here's the resource page, and the Historical Materialism book series is now doing English translations of his famous works, and I'm proud to be on the editorial board of that. So we're going to get Bogdanov circulating again. So why Bogdanov? Firstly, for his revival of the utopian imagination in the light of Marx, and you can find that in his novel, The Red Star. He understood the emotional power of a promised land, but unlike Gorky, he was not tempted by the idea of God-building. He was more interested in opening the imaginative faculties of thinking about this world. And his utopia, even though it's set on Mars, is astonishingly practical. Oh, by the way, that's The Essays in Technology, which I think is his really most interesting book. There's the English edition of Red Star. So that's the first reason. The second reason I think Bogdanov is interesting is because of what he called proletkult. Bogdanov initiated a mass movement in 1917, actually even before the revolution, that tried to become a counterpower to the state, but whose mission was proletarian culture. How could the people learn to organize themselves and their world? How could the literary classics of the past, even Shakespeare, be a way of learning what organization is so that workers can self-organize their world? Proletkult was about learning forms of self-organization that can exist outside of capital and the state and which can construct and enact a worldview based on cooperation rather than on authority or exchange value. So So thirdly, his tectology. How can all organizational tasks, whether the organizing of labor's relation to nature or organizing of different kinds of labor with each other, share and develop knowledge? How can organization be cooperative and collaborative rather than based on command, exchange value, or one might add now, protocol? His tectology is, I think, a kind of qualitative and experimental practice of sharing forms of engagement. It's an egalitarian approach to the formation of worldviews out of specific labors, each of which may have something to share that's of use to other particular labors. Interestingly, Bogdanov paired his critique of existing ideology with this project of producing a better one. So it's actually not all ideology critique. Part of it is, let's build better ideologies, because that's what motivates people. Yeah? Ideologies may be partly false, but they're also means of motivating labor. Some scholars think this is one of the origins of Gramsci's theory of counter-hegemony. Bogdanov thought that the October Revolution that founded the Soviet Union, the real organizational work was just starting, and that the real question was labor's relation to nature. Now, we don't have the luxury of waiting till, like, after a revolution, which maybe could never even happen, before figuring out labor's relation to nature. We sort of have to get started with that. We have to build other civilizations amid the ruination of this one. We're going to have to figure out a new relation between labor and nature, or capitalism, or whatever this mode of production is, still lumbers along, turning everything into a commodity. But I think Bogdanov is a useful guide to thinking and organizing otherwise. After all, as I tried to show in Molecular Red, he almost figured out anthropogenic climate change. He already understood that organized social labor on the basis of authority and exchange alone would undermine its conditions of existence in the natural world. After his arrest and release from Lubyanka prison in the early 20s, Bogdanov withdrew from political life and devoted himself to scientific work. And I got to say, that scientific work was deeply weird. It was all about blood exchange, not just blood transfusion, but exchange. If we share blood between people and we socialized it, this would be beneficial from everybody. I don't know if everybody noticed Silicon Valley venture capitalist Peter Thiel has just proposed the opposite: one-way transfusions from young people to older people to keep them alive longer. So it's like neoliberal Bogdanov. So the scientific work is really not very scientific, but he might have actually been onto something about the usefulness of blood anyway. But I'm not a hematologist. It's beyond my capabilities. All right, Bogdanov was dead by 1928 in an experiment in blood transfusion, blood exchange, just when, he believed in it, right? He died for his work. All right, this part's not funny. Dead in 28, just as Stalin consolidated his power, because it's pretty clear he would not have survived that era. So in Molecular Red, I wanted to call up a second witness to move us forward through the 20s and 30s. Who found a way of writing about the Soviet experiment in building a whole new mode of production, and that's Andrei Platonov, who I'm told is probably more widely available in translation in German than English, yeah? We're just starting to get some really great translations in English, but we lack one of his main work. I'll come to that. But in German, you can get them. Platonov is now fairly well known as a great modernist writer, but I think he was also a unique theorist in the Marxist tradition. And he's that rare thing, a modernist with an authentic proletarian background. His writing is a rare achievement in being almost completely untouched by the sort of the bourgeois novel. I put up a page so you can get the one that's out of print in English, Chevengur. But if you read English, there are these actually lovely translations that you should buy because booksellers need money, right? It's like I only share the out-of-print stuff. So Platonov came up through Bogdanov's proletcult organization, or at least some sort of faction of it. After a promising start on a career in journalism and speculative fiction, he quit to retrain as a hydrologist and electrical engineer. He'd witnessed the famine of the early Civil War period firsthand and wanted to do something practical about it, which I really admire about him, incidentally. He worked on land reclamation and agricultural engineering until first forced out of that by some murky bureaucratic wranglings. And then he returned to writing and composed a series of masterpieces. As I read them, his famous novels or anti-novels are an alternative history of the Soviet Union, seen from the point of view I would call history from below the below. So you guys know about history from below, right? It's my mostly English version of let's retell history from the point of view of the working people and women who are underneath the stories of the great men. But Platonov doesn't do that. It's history from below the below. His characters are mostly orphans, like they're not even proletarian. They have no land, no community, no family. These books are also a profound meditation on what it means to be orphaned from the world and to be orphaned from history. In Chevengur, which many people think is his masterpiece, he writes of the Civil War and the new economic policy. In Foundation Pit, I should show you all of the titles here. In Foundation Pit, he writes of Stalin's forced collectivization of agriculture, to which he was one of the few writers who was a first-hand witness. In Happy Moscow, he writes of the urban elites of the mid-30s, and in Seoul, he travels to the Far West and produces a powerful allegory on leadership and communal self-determination set within a world of harsh and unforgiving nature. Needless to say, none of these books were published in his lifetimes. Among other things, I think Platonov deepens Bogdanov's commitment to thinking and writing from the labor point of view, including a kind of sub-proletarian one. He writes of the struggle of labor against an impoverished nature, trying to build the foundation on which the exalted superstructures of this new civilization were supposed to be based. He writes of what Sartre called the practico-inert, the recalcitrant world, partly of our own making that disorganizes our labors and reduces us to passivity. There's no leaping over practicalities into the sort of communist future in Platonov. And for him, we can only ever be comrades if we face the same dangers. Far from being parodies of Soviet speak, the sort of Marxological language his characters often use, I think, is kind of in earnest. He sort of over-identifies with Marxist concepts in order to hold to account the state which can merely mouth them. And this is not the standard reading of Bogdanov, of Platonov, I don't think. So that's my particular take on him. So in sum, Bogdanov teaches us how to think from the labor point of view about the problem of organizing social labor's relation in and against nature. And Platonov teaches us just how resistant and recalcitrant nature is, how the struggle to organize life can fail, and how, I do want that one, how it's only when we are all comrades, all facing the same danger, that the struggle in and against nature has a chance. The difference in their worldviews comes in part from different forms of organizing labor that they practiced. Both were participant observers of Soviet civilization, such as it was, which tried to organize nature and labor by commanding it and fails in the attempt. So that's the first half of Molecular Red. The second half is about America, more specifically, about California in the post-war era. It's not a story of famine, but of relentless plenty. Although these days it has to be said that behind the fantasy of sun and silicon, we see ever more clearly the shortage of water and the plenitude of prisons. So who are the theorists and writers who help us see beyond what Mark Fisher diagnosed as capitalist realism in the way Platonov showed us beyond socialist realism? In the second half of Molecular Red, I look firstly to Donna Haraway and what she would call her messmates, and then to the science fiction writer Kin Stanley Robinson. Haraway is a kind of archetypal product of the military-industrial complex at its peak, on her own account. The Cold War effort against the Soviets drew women into the ranks of the scientifically trained. Just as Bogdanov started in medical science, before becoming a theorist, she started in biology. Her first book is on the organicist school of biology, which has a certain affinity with Bogdanov, it turns out. She writes there about Joseph Needham, for example, whose approach drew in part on the systems theory of Ludwig Bertalanffy, which in turn bears a striking resemblance to Bogdanov's tectology, even though he never cites it. Julia, who knows a bit more about this than I do, is saying, yeah, he stole this from Bogdanov. I can say that now, right? Yeah, yeah, stole it from Bogdanov. Right, but she's the scholar who knows these things. I'm just sort of trying to create a frame for thinking about all this. All right, so like Bogdanov, Haraway is useful for thinking through the Anthropocene because she's actually not a social constructivist, even though she's sometimes assimilated into that school. For both Bogdanov and Haraway, science at one and the same time produces verifiable knowledge of that alien inhuman world called nature, and yet is also saturated in metaphors imported from existing historical organization of labor and life. The difficulty is keeping those two ideas in one's head at the same time and not collapsing back into either the faith in a sort of metaphysical realism that's a sort of endemic worldview of the science trained, or a faith in a sort of metaphysical nominalism and social constructivism that's a sort of endemic worldview to the humanities and the social science trained. For those of us who are humanities or social science trained and who are not yet ready to give up certain ingrained habits of thought, let me just put this in tactical terms. The absolutist critique of science is now ideologically a weapon of the far right. It's the far right who deny climate science, surely one of the most important advances in knowledge of the late 20th century. So I think it really would be a good idea to stop giving any intellectual cover to climate scientists, climate denialists, and their kin. All right. And this, I put these slides together. This is a year old. Things have gotten worse. There's basically a McCarthyite witch hunt going on in the American Congress to frustrate government-funded science, not just in climate science, but in any environmental field at all. So I really feel like solidarity with our colleagues and comrades in the sciences is very, very important if you're a humanities scholar or really just believe in knowledge and its role in the world. All right, so both Bogdanov and Haraway are nevertheless proponents of a more specific critique within the sciences, right? So it's not like we have to give up, you know, thinking there's certain might be certain problems with science. In Bogdanov, it has to do with how metaphors form the social organization of labor, from the social organization of labor, find their way into scientific worldviews, even when the science it produces is verifiable. Basic metaphors drawn from authoritarian social relations and market exchange relations both enable but also limit scientific practice. A common everyday example, I don't know if you say this in German, but in English, you know, like a beehive has a queen and drones. So it's like, I don't think bees know anything about feudalism, right? It's actually not feudalism that's going on there. This is we've imported from a form of social organization, something that sort of doesn't belong there. It's perhaps unavoidable, but one needs to kind of know the implications and limits of metaphors when you use them. A more provocative one would be to suggest maybe there's a kind of a problem in thinking ecology as a self-correcting homeostasis that returns to equilibrium, because that's Adam Smith's notion of the market, yeah? That probably originally came from understandings of geology. So that's a metaphor. Like maybe it doesn't always, maybe it's not homeostatic, right? Maybe that's what the Anthropocene's about. Nature's not always homeostatic. So one has to sort of think about where the metaphors come from and that metaphors are kind of a limit and a problem without thinking that, oh, look, a metaphor has been imported to science, therefore all of science is invalid. Like that is just really taking that way too far. And that's the danger zone we've entered into now, I think, with the critique of science from the right. Anyway, so end of the sermon part. All right, so Bogdanov's whole project was to rethink science and labor together as cooperative practices without reducing them to exchange or authority. Haraway does something I think is analogous. She famously untangles metaphors of gender, sexuality, and race in the life sciences. What's less well known is her Marxist side. She extends the Marxian category of fetishism from commodity fetishism to code fetishism. In our times, the world appears not just as a vast accumulation of commodities or spectacles, but also as a vast accumulation of codes or algorithms, as if everything was run by software command. And her whole body of work is pitched against the code fetishism of genetics, for example, in favor of an organicist biology that saw code as an aspect of how bodies are organized, but not its commander. Haraway also usefully complicates Bogdanov's labor point of view, most famously in her Cyborg Manifesto, or Manifesto for Cyborgs. Bogdanov falls prey to a kind of fetishism himself in trying to think labor as if it were not always already entangled in an apparatus. Haraway's cyborg figure is a way of complicating what labor might be, introducing complexities not just about how bodies are raced and gendered, but how they're woven out of flesh and code and metal and pharmaceuticals and so much more. The cyborg is all of us. One can't separate living labor from the cyborg mesh. A consequence of this line of thought is that nature is something that can only appear as that which resists labor, including scientific labor, but that labor is always mediated by some kind of apparatus. Our knowledge is cyborg knowledge. In Molecular Ed, I follow this through the works of two people who are close to Haraway. Karen Borad restates something like Bogdanov's philosophy of science for the era of contemporary physics. Paul Edwards looks closely at the cyborg apparatus it took to produce climate science in the first place. I take the ability to say something useful about climate science to be the litmus test for any theory today. Yes, I'm in the bookstore, I'm looking at the back covers, at the famous philosophers. It's like, do they get it? No, not going to read that book. Yeah? It's like at some point one has to sort of start looking. Like, who gets it? Who gets what happened in the world? Clearly, many of our favorites from the archive seem also to sort of fail that kind of test, given how much of the work of their epigenes marches on as if the Earth were still flat, or the same thing was not the object of an anthropogenic effect with the capacity to crash it. Now, Paul Edwards, who was Haraway's student provides in his book A Vast Machine a really useful reading of climate science as something that arose out of three things. The deployment of an apparatus that was largely military in origin, such as computers and satellites, which also required advances in mathematical physics and, perhaps most important, a culture of international scientific collaboration and cooperation. Ironically enough, the kind of self-organized, collaborative love of labor that is scientific and that Bogdanov put such trust in was the very thing that produced this most useful mission-critical knowledge about nature, climate science. It partly derives from the military, but partly derives from the kind of collaborative practice Bogdanov was talking about. There's been a revival of interest and things to do with objects and even materialism of late. But in Molecular Red, I show why I think some of these miss the mark. Firstly, any theory that does not get some notion of the Anthropocene quickly yet efficiently, yet critically, seems to me not to be doing the job of thinking the times. And this is why I find some of the new materialisms of the vibrating, the vital, or of the void just like a little bit off topic. Secondly, there seems to be a tendency in them to reinstate philosophy as first philosophy, as legislating for what matters, as if high theory still had the authority to do such a thing. What I find more useful is the kind of low theory or collaborative practice, a tectology that Bogdanov and, in her own way, Haraway, were working on, a kind of interstitial rather than dominant role for theory. They're about porting metaphors between labors of knowing, where concepts are selected and tested in each field, rather than legislating from a centralized philosophical party. They aren't short a kind of organizational work or cooperative systems practice. It's really hard to find a stock photograph for collaborative labor. Like, that's really a problem. Like, Google collaborative labor image, and you don't get anything interesting. So I'm sorry this picture is all men, but Jules Dassin, who came to Europe because of the blacklist, couldn't make movies in America. Rafifi is a film noir crossed with a robbery caper movie, but where these professional thieves collaborate to steal the jewels is the most beautiful 10 minutes of a film about collaboration you ever saw. And these guys don't even all speak the same language, but boy, can they steal jewels, right? So it's kind of no accident that Dassin was a Hollywood leftist. Like, collaboration and labor is what cinema's all about. So it's just like a little side note here that it's hard to even picture what collaboration is supposed to be about. So that's why I got this picture for you. Now, this, I think, is the task for the theoretically minded today, not to issue edicts from what we imagine on high to be the state of the world. Nobody much cares about our grand pronouncements anyway. Rather, it's to create interstitial communications, to get percepts, concepts, and affects to move between fields, to propose things from one field that might be useful to another, always bearing in mind that it is not theory that legislates on what is and what isn't for all fields. Rather, each field of knowledge is its own keeper of the protocols of such decisions. And then one can also ask questions about these metaphors of legislating and protocols, right? So, again, for those for whom this is not theoretically satisfying, consider it as a practical matter. Nobody is ever going to agree on a particular philosophy, new materialist or otherwise. So why hold up the urgent work of building a new civilization for what would be an endless debate about first principles? In any case, for those of us with a Marxist bent, such concepts arise out of practice, not the other way around. And again, I couldn't find the picture, so here's another great European movie that's got images about different points of view. As I was writing Molecular Red, I took a break to waste some time on social media. And there, in my feed, it just lit up with a story about U.S. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma using a snowball to disprove the scientific and anthropogenic global warming. Global warming being what the right wing wants to call it, because that sounds great. Yeah, it's warm today. Global warming feels great. I think we've got to start calling it climate disruption, right? Now, this guy was, at the time, chair of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, right? And is a denialist. As we saw in the last presidential election, it would seem that the United States is some sort of death wish, a fanaticism that wills it towards extinction. If hard-won scientific knowledge about nature appears to set limits on the endless commodification of everything, then the sock puppets of the commodifiers will take to the bully pulpits to declare that the Earth is flat. And I got to say, Europe might not be immune to that particular tendency. So it's time to all make our own versions of this sign and get out there. So to some extent, we're on our own. We have to build a new civilization, one that maybe won't quite look like this. We have to build a new civilization in the pores of the old one and maybe do it on the quiet. Maybe we could just do our modest bit to try out percepts, affects, and concepts that might be useful. Can we actually perceive what's really on the agenda for history? Can we generate useful ways of feeling about situations and their actual possibilities? Can we organize perception and affect in useful and open-ended but not too open-ended ways? Such might be the rudiments of a low theory or a tectology for today. Now, while Haraway's work is rich in material from science fiction, and the Manifesto for Cyborgs was intentionally constructed as a political myth, perhaps there's a need for a more extensive practice of imagining other worlds. And this is why I end Molecular Red with the work of Kim Stanley Robinson. Anybody read the famous Mars trilogy? Ah, no. Well, we got one person. Read some KSR. There's new book called Aurora, which is probably a better place to start because the Mars trilogy is long. Read Aurora, or this one called 2312, which I highly recommend. Like kind of what used to be called hard science fiction, right? So that gets the science right, but kind of imagining possibilities for the human within that space. But I wrote about Mars trilogy in Molecular Red because it's a sort of self-conscious updating of Bogdanov's Red Star. Maybe not an accident. Robinson was once actually a student of Frederick Jameson, so his novels offer particular delights for those who know their Western Marxism, even though they're kind of aimed at a general readership. Like Bogdanov, Robinson builds a socialist utopia on Mars. What makes it different to Bogdanov and more of a piece with our times is that Robinson imagines more of what you might call a meta-utopia. Robinson's task is not to advocate one organizational form, but to show how all of them might negotiate with each other. He actually even writes an imaginary constitution for Mars after the revolution, right? And it's not there's one way of doing things. It's about here's how we negotiate between different versions of the good life. So he does in utopian fiction something equivalent to what I'm calling low theory, negotiate between different kinds of labor and the worldviews that they generate. And nothing I love, he's called Stan in real life. Nothing I love about Stan, he's the only Californian I know who's written a book about New York, my hometown, in the future where he didn't destroy it. Right? Every Hollywood movie about New York in the future, they frickin' destroy us. It's like, why do you hate us? Stan didn't do that. His New York is lovely because we endure with great difficulty. That's what it looks like, the cover. So I may have lost some people here with the mere mention of the word utopia, but I don't see utopias as ideal or perfect or imaginary or hopeful or unrealistic. If you want unrealistic worlds, try the bourgeois novel. Compare Stendhal to Charles Fourier. It's the utopian Fourier who thinks about who takes out the trash, right? There's a whole chapter in Fourier's about, yeah, like, the shit. Who deals with that? Like, he has an answer. Yeah? Like, there's nothing about that in Jane Austen. Yeah? Or, you know, the novel doesn't deal with reality in that sense. Utopias do. That's the paradoxical thought I want to leave you with here. So I'd see utopias as intensely practical, actually as the practical taken to extremes. Using the estrangement effect of setting the action on Mars, Robinson, like Bogdanov, asked practical questions about how to organize labor, including scientific and technical labor, where the production of exchange value does not determine use value anymore. Because if you want a totally unreal fantasy world, it's the one we actually imagine we're in. It has already ceased to exist, yeah? We're living in a world that's not real. We just don't quite realize it yet. We're already in the next act of trying to build another world. So my modest proposal is to use the university and adjacent institutions, such as this one, as a place to experiment with forms of collaborative world-making, with systems, practices, with low theories, with technologies. Call it what you like. This does not even have to be about the Anthropocene, because that it gets depressing after a while, right? The Anthropocene shapes the agenda for knowledge, but the agenda need not be obsessively about it, which is why I called molecular red theory for the Anthropocene, not of, yeah? At some point, it's like, all right, we know what the agenda is. Let's go get on with our other tasks. So what resources can we pull from the archive that might usefully contribute labor in and against nature, to labor in and against nature, which do not completely dominate through forms of control, through forms of exchange value? What ways can those of us who practice the language arts contribute to the interpretive and translation problems between all of the other kinds of labor that it takes to make a world? In Molecular Red, I was interested in how the Anthropocene might approach the archive differently. I guess, can we have a different relation to the archive? Yeah, I was sort of like taking a dive into the past time. And I'll just conclude with a brief word about a more recent book, which is General Intellects. So if Molecular Red sort of takes the long view, long historical times, going back a century, General Intellects sort of takes the broad view, sort of across contemporary theoretical practices. The 21 pieces that make up this book move from political economy to political theory to cultural studies, media studies, science studies. It moves across fields looking for ways to port metaphors from one domain of knowledge production to another without making any of them primary. So I refuse to treat philosophy or political economy or any other field as sovereign. Rather, I try to get them to cooperate. And this is actually the hardest thing about working between the so-called disciplines. And this, I think, is quite different to the interdisciplinary, which mostly is about sort of staking out separate fields of sovereignty by vigilantly policing the borders. I don't think that will work anymore. The Anthropocene obliges us to organize knowledge differently. It's probably not helpful to think of this as a crisis, as crisis signals a sort of effective responses of panic and helplessness, not to mention offering an opening for all kinds of authoritarians, offering false comforts. Rather, I think it's best to just coolly keep working, but to organize our work differently. Let's work collaboratively on building a new civilization here in the ruins of the old one. You don't have to look far to see the certain rather forward-thinking members of the ruling class are indeed building their own private arcs. They've decided to be traitors to our species being. They've decided to loot what they can from this civilization based on the application of intensive information-based management to the command and control of nature and labour's resources measured only in exchange value. They know it can't last. Luxury survivalism is now a market niche. They're building private armies or bunkers in New Zealand or dreaming of space. But where they get to go to space without us? So it might be timely to start work on Plan B for the 99%. And those of us who've led comfortable lives here in the overdeveloped world should make no mistake about this. As far as the current ruling class is concerned, we're part of the disposable 99%. We too are surplus population. If you want a fictional space in which to explore how this might feel, I really recommend, anyone read William Gibson's The Peripheral? Super recommend this one. It sort of gets the affect and the tone of the moment. What's peripheral to the ruling class of today is us. So let's come up with another plan and another practice for living and loving and working. Let's build a new civilization. Does that sound like fun? Yeah, let's do it. That's all I got. Thank you.